headlines. Iran says the finalization of the Vienna talks and the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides of negotiations. The Taliban militant group says that it will present a peace proposal to the Afghan government as the warring sides resume the long-stalled peace talks in Qatar. And Canadian firefighters are battling to contain some 200 wildfires amid an unprecedented and deadly heat wave in the country. Thanks for joining us. Iran says the finalization of any agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides involved in the talks over the accord. The foreign ministry spokesman said that all sides to the talks have acknowledged progress in the negotiations. However, Saeed Khatibzadeh added, important issues have remained that need to be decided on by the other parties, especially the U.S. He said Tehran's main policy is the removal of sanctions and added, that policy will remain unchanged under the new Iranian government. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal began talks to revive it in April, 3 years after the U.S. left the accord. The German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, has said that a deal to save the accord can be reached in the coming weeks. Political analyst Tim Anderson says Europe has done little to preserve the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and has been too weak to stand up to Washington's stubbornness.
The Europeans have done little to try and maintain this agreement. They've been too weak to stand up against the Trump administration when it reneged on the deal. And from the Iranian side, I mean, I know certainly the current administration would like to see an outcome there, and perhaps they're talking positively about it, but I don't think they're going to give in to their position, which is a strong moral position that the U.S. has to show some real dropping of sanctions. And so I don't really think that the Iranian side is going to make any concessions, and I don't think that the Washington side is capable of doing it. But in terms of returning to the 2015 agreement, I just don't think it's going to happen. I think there may be some other accommodation beyond the 2015 deal, but I think returning to that is virtually impossible in these circumstances. However, it might be that the Biden administration is able to start talking to Iran on a different basis and perhaps remove some of the sanctions there. Remember, there are a number of sanctions that the U.S. they shouldn't be called sanctions. They're unilateral coercive measures. They're illegal, basically. But I think that the Biden administration might try and soften some of those as some sort of concession to keep a dialogue of goodwill going with Tehran. But I don't look for much more than that.
The Taliban say that they are planning to present a written peace proposal to the Afghan government as early as next month. The spokesman for the militant group said that the peace talks with the government will be accelerated in the coming days. Zabihullah Mujahid added that the talks will take a month before the two sides reach a stage where they can exchange peace plans. A new round of talks began in the Qatari capital Doha last week. That coincided with the U.S. handover of Bagram Air Base near Kabul to the Afghan forces almost after two decades. The U.S. has already announced the complete pullout of its forces from the country before September 11.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by U.S. President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Iraqi security officials say that a drone has been intercepted and shot down by American forces over an area close to the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. The officials said that the drone was downed before reaching the embassy compound. Videos posted on social media showed American defense systems firing rockets into the air in Baghdad. The incident comes hours after the U.S.-led military coalition said that at least three rockets targeted the Ain al-Assad airbase hosting American forces in western Iraq. It said the attack left no injuries but caused material damage to the base. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. U.S. bases and their supply convoys in Iraq have come under increasing attacks amid growing anti-American sentiments in the Arab country. The U.S. official has warned that the deteriorating economic conditions in Iraq and in Syria is providing a fertile ground for the Takfiri terrorists to reconstitute. That is while the U.S. and its allies' military intervention in both countries has merely added fuel to the fire of instability, further deepening the current socioeconomic crises there.
The United States envoy to the U.S.-led anti-Daesh coalition has warned of a possible resurgence of the Takfiri terrorists in Iraq and Syria due to worsening poverty and inequity there. But what is the root cause of the instability and poverty afflicting Baghdad and Damascus? 2 years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos resulted from the U.S. invasion eventually gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. 3 years after, the Takfiri group captured nearly one-third of Iraq's territory. However, Baghdad finally declared victory over the terrorists in December 2017. The victory was owed to the bravery of Commanders Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis that played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists. However, in a criminal and terrorist act, the U.S. killed these two figures in January 2020. That blatantly contradicts Washington's concern about the resurgence of Daesh. Following the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, anti-U.S. sentiments escalated in Iraq. U.S. bases in the country have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. That later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. While the U.S. claims it cares about Syrian civilians, it has imposed crippling economic sanctions on Syria that prevent the country from rebuilding after a decade of war.
It's really hard to be really clear about what's the motivation here, because it could just be stupidity. There's a lot of stupidity in U.S. foreign policy, pig-headedness. The CIA, when people say, why do you keep invading and destroying countries when it doesn't work, when it doesn't help you? And the answer that the CIA gives is, it's what we do. It's what we do. It's just that's the way we function. It's almost like it's an instinct to invade, to create chaos. So that's one possibility. Another one that's related to this is could just be sour grapes. It could be spoil sport, that the U.S. sees that these countries want to become independent, want to develop independently of the United States.
Well, Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy since March of 2011. Damascus says Western governments and their regional allies are aiding Takfiri terrorist groups that are wreaking havoc in the Arab country. Meanwhile, the U.S. and its allies refuse to recognize the legitimacy of the Syrian government and have placed a crippling blockade in Damascus, dubbed the Caesar Act.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple the government of President Bashar Assad. After failing to do so through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government implemented additional sanctions on Syria through a law known as the Caesar Act. The crippling sanctions under the Caesar Act specifically target energy and construction sectors to prevent Syria from rebuilding after a decade of war. The Caesar Act enabled Washington to sanction any person involved in reconstruction efforts in government-controlled parts of Syria. The correlation between U.S. economic sanctions and the crisis in Syria is clear. Syria's currency has plummeted and prices for basic goods have soared as a result of the sanctions. According to the UN, 60% of Syrians lack access to sufficient food. Besides the economic embargo, the U.S. has also occupied oil fields in Syria's northeast, depriving Damascus of a vital resource. Moreover, the UN has warned that U.S. sanctions have hampered humanitarian aid deliveries in Syria.
Yes, they do want a certain amount of instability and chaos wherever their own interests are threatened. So Syria, it was clearly the strongest anti-imperialist, anti-American force, anti-Israel force in the Middle East.
Washington alerts that Daesh terrorists might start regaining territory in Iraq and Syria as a result of poverty and instability there. That's why the U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socioeconomic conditions there. Besides sanctions, U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh never would have formed.
Firefighters are battling nearly 200 wildfires raging in western Canada amid an unprecedented heat wave there. Officials say that two-thirds of the fires have gone out of control in the Pacific province of British Columbia. Dozens of personnel have arrived from across Canada to help contain roaring flames. The wildfires have prompted evacuations in several towns, including Lytton. A blaze hit the town last week, raising it to the ground. Temperatures have set records in different parts of British Columbia, the mercury reaching 50 degrees Celsius. The heat wave has killed hundreds of people in Canada over the past 2 weeks. Lebanon's Hezbollah leader Said Hassan Nasrallah describes resistance media as partners in all victories achieved so far against the oppressors. He also praises the media for breaking the U.S. hegemony in the region. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayyid Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayyid Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The new UK Health and Social Care Secretary, Sajid Javid, has said the best way to protect the nation's health was by lifting the main COVID-19 restrictions. He said rules that we have had to put in place have caused a shocking rise in domestic violence and a terrible impact on so many people's mental health. We're prepared for you an article written by Linda Geeds. The piece is titled, UK Scientists Caution That Lifting of COVID Rules is Like Building Variant Factories. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more. UK scientists have warned that the lifting of all COVID-19 restrictions is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate, and said the attitude of the new Health and Social Care Secretary Sajid Javid is frightening. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, on 4th of July, Sajid Javid said the best way to protect the nation's health was lifting the main COVID-19 restrictions. He said rules that we have had to put in place have caused a shocking rise in domestic violence and a terrible impact on so many people's mental health. Reacting to the comments, Professor Stephen Riker of the University of St Andrews in Scotland, a member of the SAGE subcommittee advising on behavioural science, tweeted, "It is frightening to have a health secretary who still thinks COVID is flu, who is unconcerned at levels of infection, who doesn't realise that those who do best for health also do best for the economy, who wants to ditch all protections while only half of us are vaccinated." Professor Stephen Riker said, "Above all, it's frightening to have a health secretary who wants to make all protections a matter of personal choice, when the key message of the pandemic is, this isn't an I thing, it's a we thing." In the coming days, the Cabinet is expected to sign off on the easing of various COVID restrictions in England, including allowing fully vaccinated adults to travel to Amber-list countries without having to self-isolate when they return home, making wearing of face masks voluntary apart from in hospitals and other healthcare settings, and no longer requiring fully vaccinated adults to take a COVID-19 test or self-isolate if they've come into contact with an infected person. The school bubble system that has forced hundreds of thousands of pupils to self-isolate at home if someone in their bubble tests positive is also expected to be dropped, while pub and restaurant customers may no longer have to scan an NHS QR code upon their arrival. Health Secretary Sajid Javid said, "We need to be clear that cases are going to rise significantly. I know many people will be cautious about the easing of restrictions. That's completely understandable. But no date we choose will ever come without risk, so we have to take a broad and balanced view." He added, "We are going to have to learn to accept the existence of COVID and find ways to cope with it, just as we already do with the flu." Professor Susan Michie, a director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London and another member of SAGE's Behavioural Science Subcommittee, tweeted, "Allowing community transmission to surge is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate." Writing in a blog for the British Medical Journal last week, Professor Susan Michie, together with Professor Riker and Professor Anne Phoenix at University College London's Institute of Education, said Health Secretary Sajid Javid's singular emphasis on responsibility of individuals to identify and mitigate against COVID-19 risks took the emphasis away from what the government must also do. They said, "If people are to act responsibly, they need their government to fulfil its own responsibilities to make safe behaviour possible." The fear is that when government talks about a freedom day, when all restrictions are lifted, it doesn't mean that the virus has gone away, and it doesn't mean that the measures are not needed to prevent a resurgence. They noted, "What it does mean is that the government is planning to withdraw all forms of support and abandon us to deal with the pandemic on our own." However, other scientists have said the relaxation of many of the restrictions, while not risk-free, actually made sense. Paul Hunter, a professor of medicine at the University of East Anglia, said, "Double vaccinated people are less likely to get an infection, and even if infected, are less likely to infect others." Similarly, he said, the additional risk posed by relaxing mask wearing was unlikely to be great, although it made sense for vulnerable groups to wear face masks in crowded indoor environments, and for those visiting very vulnerable individuals indoors, at least whilst community rates remained high. Professor Paul Hunter said, "The school bubble system may have had some value, but if we accept that we're all going to get repeated SARS-CoV-2 infections throughout life, and we are unlikely to vaccinate children under the age of 11 and may not vaccinate children from 11 to 16, then all this can be said to be doing is delaying the inevitable. This is causing considerable disruption for relatively little benefit." He added, "Even relying on daily testing of asymptomatic individuals is open to debate." Professor Paul Hunter noted, "Of course, we have seen new issues appear during the course of this epidemic, and so no one can be certain of the challenges over coming months. But we will eventually come into an equilibrium with this virus, as we have with all other endemic respiratory infections." Professor Alison Pollock, a clinical professor of public health at Newcastle University, claimed Health Secretary Jarvis' approach was sensible. She said, "Population immunity is rapidly being achieved due to a combination of naturally acquired immunity through infection and vaccination. Unknowns are duration of immunity, impact of variants, and who is at individual risk of reinfection or transmission." Professor Alison Pollock said, "Good infection and outbreak control measures are still important at local level. However, mass testing and daily testing should be stopped, as testing of asymptomatic people is causing unnecessary harm with no evidence that it contributes to reducing transmission." Meanwhile, according to a report, more than one in four young people are worried that poor mental health will affect their ability to find work after the COVID-19 pandemic. After the opening up of the British economy this spring, the Resolution Foundation said young workers were still suffering a heavier toll than their older colleagues and were paying a heavier price with their mental health. It said that 18 to 24-year-olds were 2.5 times more likely at the end of May to be out of work or still on furlough than any other age group, even after the reopening of hospitality venues across the United Kingdom as activity returns to Britain's high streets. It comes amid mounting concerns over the lasting impact of the crisis for young people after 15 months of unprecedented disruption to their education and the start of their working lives. With separate research published recently by the Institute for Fiscal Studies warning that those getting on the career ladder for the first time could bear the scars of the COVID recession for years to come. Despite the opening up of the economy this spring, the Resolution Foundation said more than one in five adults aged between 18 and 24 reported struggles with mental health last month. In a survey of more than 8,000 adults undertaken by YouGov on behalf of the think tank and the Health Foundation charity, fewer than half, or 48%, said their mental health was good. This compared with a much higher rate of 64% for 55-year-olds to 64-year-olds. More than one in four, or 27%, of 18 to 24-year-olds said they were worried about finding a job in the coming months because of their mental health situation, compared with about one in five people aged between 35 and 54, and only one in 10 aged between 55 and 64. Rukmin Sehmi, a senior research and policy analyst at the Resolution Foundation, said young people have been hit hardest by the COVID-19 economic crisis, which has taken its toll on their mental health. Rukmin Sehmi said, Worryingly, some young people are struggling even while the economy is recovering, and they are fearful about their career prospects. These fears must not be underestimated. The evidence comes as the Institute for Fiscal Studies said young adults were battling greater challenges in the world of work than their older peers as pandemic restrictions are relaxed. The influential think tank said there were growing risks that young workers would bear the scars of the COVID-19 recession for years to come. It said young adults had avoided sliding into poverty during the crisis because of the government's furlough scheme, and as they chose to delay the start of their careers by staying at home, living with their parents while the pandemic continues. Official figures show that under-25s have accounted for two-thirds of the decline in employment in the United Kingdom during the coronavirus pandemic and were more likely to be placed on furlough than older staff.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says the removal of the Israeli regime and the liberation of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is closer than ever today. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah also said that the U.S. hegemony is the most dangerous threat that's facing the West Asian region. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the axis of resistance in the West Asia region has grown and what plans the U.S. and its allies may have to weaken it. First, let's cross on over to Beirut and talk to our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who will give us some highlights, Mariam, if you can, of some of the most important points that Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah stated today.
Well, usually the speeches of Sayed Nasrallah are very much fruitful. There are so many details in there, but you mentioned one of them, which is very significant, that the liberation of Palestine, liberation of Al-Quds, is very close. And he believes that this is because the resistance force or the resistance alliance in the region is much stronger than it has in the past. He mentioned that the last 10 years or the last decade was one of the most difficult periods that the resistance was able to surpass. And at the same time, there are the different forms of resistance that are also very much in unity in trying to show this strength. And one of them is media. And that was one of the reasons why he was speaking today, to show that media is a partner in the victory that happened lately in the battle for Al-Quds or the previous battles or any battle in the future. And he stressed on that point that the media needs to highlight and needs to voice that need or that equation that all the leaders of the resistance are voicing, which is that if Jerusalem Al-Quds is under any aggression by the Israelis once again, like Sheikh Jarrah in the past, then therefore this would lead to a regional war and not only a confrontation between the Palestinian resistance in Gaza and the Israeli occupation forces. So that is also another very important point that he mentioned and tried to strengthen it, of course, and to highlight that point.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That's Mariam Saleh there, correspondent from Beirut. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joins us from Brussels. And also joining us is historian and journalist Brent Jonkers, who joins us from Hasselt. I'd like to welcome you both, and let me start with you first, Brent Jonkers, if I may, and break down one of the highlights of what the Hezbollah Secretary General has said, and that is the U.S. hegemony is the most dangerous threat facing West Asia. Tell us if you agree with that, and in what ways, if you do agree with him, is that true?
Well, I think that's absolutely spot on. Like the U.S. Hegemonistic imperialist venture in worldwide is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, threats that the world faces, and definitely in West Asia, or in like in the region that in the West is often called the Middle East, this hegemony is way more, it's all the more obvious, all the more aggressive, and all the more warmongering, especially in the past 20 years, ever since 2001. I think this is something that it should be so obvious by now that everyone who is not too blind or too unwilling to see it has to admit this. So the United States has, through various ways of meddling, interference, aggression, invasion, really spread its tentacles around West Asia and is trying to squeeze life out of it, and has been doing this for decades now. Of course, there is the constant bipartisan, as well, support from the United States to Israel to the tune of billions and billions of dollars every single year, both monetary, financial, as of course, a military support. Then there is the support to various imperialist conflicts and the invasion of independent sovereign nations. Of course, we had the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the continuous occupation that still exists to this day, despite constant and repeated demands by Iraq, including the parliament, including the government of Iraq, that the United States has to leave. We've seen the United States' completely illegal invasion of northeastern Syria, the occupation of Hazakah and other areas in northeastern Syria under the guise of what they call the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is completely illegal according to any and all international humanitarian law, completely against the basic concept of national sovereignty of nations. We have seen the invasion in Libya. We have seen the overthrow and the infiltration in legitimate grievances, legitimate protests that existed in the wake of the Arab Spring in 2011, when the United States immediately decided to basically to butt in, to hijack any potential popular outbursts of anger and to steer them towards a way that will end up being more imperialist. And that is, I believe, what Syed Nasrallah has been talking about when he says that the previous period has been so difficult for the resistance, and yet they succeed in overcoming it and defeating it and coming out stronger. This is that period, especially the last decade, that period of imperialist hijacking of this so-called Arab Spring movement and this massive support of Western imperialist powers to every form of reactionary government, reactionary movement, terrorist organization that wishes to overthrow legitimate governments and states that are too independent to the liking of the West. So all these things together, they constitute a very obvious, I think, evidence of the fact that, like Syed Nasrallah said, that the United States' presence in this hegemony is the biggest threat that West Asia is facing right now, and probably the biggest threat they have faced in a very long time.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, another thing that Syed Hassan Nasrallah said on the same topic is that the U.S. seeks to expand its hegemony by supporting Israel. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the U.S. Influence in the region really waning? Because when he took at certain countries like Syria, like Iraq, of course Iran, we know where that stands, even with Turkey and other countries, it's not really the support that it used to have, if you agree. And therefore, is that the possibility of this Abraham Accords to come into the picture, to have that relationship established between them and Israel, so that the U.S. remains, so to speak, a player, and at the same time, Israel is protected?
Well, we see that the role of the U.S. in the Middle East is parallel to the ultimate support of Israel and to keep its hegemony in West Asia, to prevent Russia, Iran, and China from moving in. We see that the U.S. hegemony is fading slowly but surely. However, the U.S. still has enough power to make sure that this is, the countries like, for example, Iraq is under its thumb and threatening the Iraqi government with sanctions, like it is doing also with Iran, and is doing with Syria, and is doing with Lebanon. Therefore, yes, we see that the Americans are supporting Israel to unlimited level. However, the Israeli themselves can see that their power is also declining, after the war in Lebanon in 2006, after the failure of the partition of Syria and the partition of Iraq, and recently the sword of Jerusalem imposed by Gaza, Israel is no longer as strong as it used to claim to be, the strongest country in the Middle East or the strongest army in the Middle East. On the contrary, we saw that a small number of resistance of people who want to resist against the U.S. hegemony and against the Israeli expansion are managing to impose on Israel its deterrence and making sure that Israel cannot violate their sovereignty anytime Israel wants. And that affects also the U.S. control of the Middle East that is also going down. Particularly we see in Syria, the Americans are starting to be under attack. In Iraq, they are under continuous attack by the resistance. Many countries don't want them anymore. They want them to leave. But what the only thing that the Americans are doing is making sure that to create havoc in the Middle East when they are not wanted and they're not trying to do anything constructive.
Well, Brett Yockers, I noticed Elijah Magner again saying something along the lines that I said, and that is the support of the U.S. for the U.S. is not as it used to be. U.S. still has influence in the region. And also, Israel is not on the solid footing that it thought that it should be. I mean, if you really think about it, all the support, all the military aid that the U.S. gives Israel, and all the military hardware that the U.S. has spilt into the region, in retrospect, what has that gotten them? Reminds us of what Donald Trump said, that, you know, trillions of dollars, and what does the U.S. have to show for it? So when Hassan Nasrallah says that the U.S. seeks to expand its hegemony to continue its support for Israel, and at the same time, the removal of the Israeli regime and the liberation of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is closer than ever today. Does that hold true in a way that it hasn't in the past, especially when we look at Palestine and the Gaza Strip coming fresh off that the win off that 11-day war?
I think that is absolutely it's absolutely true, and that is something that in it is often let's say obfuscated, especially of course in imperialist mass media, mainstream media. The fact that Israel is this, it claims to be this sort of giant, but it's a giant with a very very weak legs, let's say, to stand on. It cannot, the base of Israel itself, both militarily, ideologically, but even demographically, the base of Israel is extremely fragile. And the most interesting example of that, I think, is the fact that the former head of Shin Bet, which is the internal security service of the Zionist entity, he went to one of the leading newspapers of Israel just a couple of months ago, and he spoke openly in Zionist mainstream media, and he said that Israel will most likely not survive the coming generation, so the coming couple of decades. And the reason for that, he did not even speak necessarily of what will happen militarily, but he said demographically speaking, the support for Zionism in Israel is based for the most part on this, what they call these so-called liberal Jews, or these so-called non-religious Jews, so people who are in reality not religiously Jewish at all, but see themselves as still as some part of some sort of chosen race that has the right to this country. But this power base of Israel is, percentually speaking, declining, and especially when compared to other groups that live in the Zionist entity. And which group are those? The majority of the other groups that exist are what the Israeli call Israeli Arabs, but which in reality are Palestinians. The Palestinian population in Israel, especially after the 1967 war and the occupation of East Jerusalem and major parts, of course, of the West Bank, this population has been increasing gradually. And in general, they also have larger families, and they have their percentage, the share in the population is rising. For obvious reasons that I don't think I need to explain, the Palestinians who live in quote-unquote Israel, generally speaking, do not support the Zionist entity or the Zionist project. And the interesting part is that another part of the Zionist population that is growing really massively and exponentially is the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, people who are actually religiously Jewish. And the interesting thing here is that a big part of these religious Jews also don't support the Zionist entity as it exists. These are Jews who just want to practice their faith. Yes, of course, they want to live in the area where they live in, but they don't necessarily support a Zionist Jew-only state because they know that they don't need a Jewish-dominated state in order to be Jews. The Jews have lived for thousands of years all across the world, especially in the Middle East, especially in Islamic and Christian nations in the Middle East. They have lived there peacefully and generally unharmed. And these people know that it is possible for a Palestinian state to be multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and still maintain a sort of peaceful coexistence between Jewish Christians and Muslims. And so all these things together, that is just purely the demographic point of view. Even if there was no conflict happening, this is what the Shin Bet leader said, even without the conflict, Israel is demographically doomed to fail. Now, when you see, of course, the resistance coming on top of that, this resistance is growing as well exponentially. You have the resistance in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, mm-hmm. which is increasing their activities more and more and more. And this will come to blows sooner or later, and eventually, I believe, lead to the destruction of the Zionist project and the Zionist colonial entity on the land of Palestine.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, Elijah, if you don't mind expanding more about the axis of resistance. Is something that the U.S. and its allies have not appreciated. They have tried to break that up. How far along have they come, or have they actually been defeated in that journey? Because as it stands, the axis of resistance, if anything, it appears that they've grown stronger. We can take a look at the most recent 11-day war. The Palestinian resistance factions were able to claim victory over that. Many agree that that is indeed what happened. Is that the reality, the new reality, the axis of resistance unbreakable and to have grown stronger, and the U.S. perhaps has been defeated in trying to break that up?
Well, yes, using different methods. So we see the Americans tried to use boots on the ground by occupying Afghanistan and Iraq, and it didn't work. We saw Israel trying to defeat Hezbollah and didn't work, and exactly the same in Gaza, and we saw also that in Yemen and through Saudi hands. So now the Americans are trying something else that is called the soft power, and the soft power is to turn the inhabitants against one another, and this is what they are trying in Iraq. And we can't say they are succeeding, but they have succeeded in creating a domestic havoc and turning the population one against another by using legitimate requests like corruption and job opportunities and the lack of basic services. And they use that also in Lebanon. They're imposing sanctions on Syria to turn the population against the government in Damascus. So they're no longer using the military because point they have been defeated militarily. And we saw that Iran moved to the level of full empowerment when it has bombed Ain al-Assad, the largest U.S. base, which means sending a direct message to the American that I am ready to fight face to face, and I no longer need to rely on my allies to do the job, but we all are on the same line. Therefore, there is a new method, and this new method is going toward the population and creating a storm internally and trying to turn people against each other or the population, the society against the government. And this way, they impoverish the population. They don't care about it, and they create such a discontent so the population blame anybody, including the axis of the resistance, and in this case in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and in Gaza, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and in Syria, the Syrian government, and in Iraq, the Hashd al-Shaabi, or the Iraqi resistance groups that are against the U.S. occupation forces. And partially they have succeeded partially in doing so. Now it is up to the people to be more aware of the American doing and understand that patience is their best weapons, and that this is part of the war that Israel and the Americans are waging against them because they've been defeated militarily. As simple as that.
Trying to figure out exactly what is going on, Brent Yonkers, when it comes to Syria and the U.S. position. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah did condemn the U.S. airstrikes that happened in the same area, the Syria-Iraq border. And it seems like the U.S. has a focus on Syria that it has not changed from the past, and that is obviously the ultimate goal, is this obsession with having Assad be removed. It even goes as far as talking to its allies, saying do not establish a relationship with Assad, even though they want to, at this point, have accepted the fact that, you know, Assad's there to stay. It had elections. He was reelected. Why is the U.S. so keen on its focus on Syria? Is it because of Israel, to make sure that that pathway is there so that Israel can continue its attacks on Syria?
I think that is absolutely a very important influence. We can never underestimate the influence of the Zionist entity and the Zionist lobbies on anything, especially foreign policy, that the United States is doing. We have seen now in the 11-day war, in the entire conflict, the sort of Al-Quds battles, that the Palestinian resistance suddenly, almost seemingly suddenly, had a very modern state-of-the-art equipment at their possession that they most likely have had in their arsenal for quite some time, but now have really been showing. And that that a lot of this arsenal most likely comes through Syria into Palestine. This is one of the big accomplishments as well of the Shahid Qasem Soleimani, of course, is the support of this bringing of modern equipment to Palestine through support and supporters and resistance members and resistance organizations in both Iraq and Syria. And that way you get into occupied Palestine and into the and eventually into the still free part of Palestine, which is Gaza. So when these this focus on Syria keeps on going, not so much in the media anymore, because the United States and the Western allies, they try, of course, to sort of downplay the fact that they are still there, that right. They are actually occupying a big part of northeastern Syria, illegally, without even so much as a UN mandate. But this conflict keeps on going. Today, still, there was a report that broke that 45 trucks were seen trucking oil and grain from Syria, stealing it from Syria, and crossing into Iraq to go to American bases. So this is all part, for a big part, of course, of this Israeli Zionist focus on trying to keep on dismantling and balkanizing Syria, with the eventual goal, of course, of destroying Syria as a country entirely.
Yeah, sorry to jump in. I'm going to ask the last question from Elijah Magnier. At the end of his speech, Elijah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah talked about Lebanon, and that this should not be the state of Lebanon, and the reason why it's experiencing such harsh financial meltdown, if you want to call it that, is because the U.S., he didn't put all the blame on the U.S., but he said the U.S. is preventing Lebanon from getting investments into the country because of the sanctions that have occurred, and that it is a major factor in the prevention of Lebanon from advancing to try to bring itself out of the hole that it's in. Is that, again, because of Israel that the U.S. may be doing that? Because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and the resistance movement is there in Lebanon?
Hezbollah is the strongest, one of the strongest armies in the Middle East. It is organized but a regular army, and it represents a real danger to Israel. And as I said previously, Israel tried to defeat it and failed. So the only possibility now is to go to internal domestic bickering. And what the problem of Lebanon is, the U.S. support to its allies that are accused of corruption throughout the last three decades. These are the people who are not satisfied with what's happening in Lebanon. They're preventing China from coming in. They're preventing Iran from sending oil paid by the Lebanese with Lebanese lira, local currency that nobody wants, and preventing Russia from reconstructing the country. That is what the Americans are doing. So the pressure remains not only on Hezbollah, but also the society that supports Hezbollah, that is Shia and Nasrallah.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in. I'm sorry. We're just fresh out of time. That's Elijah Magnier. Thank you, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, historian and journalist Brent Yonkers, for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tarvey and the entire team, is goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.